Good evening, and thank you so much for being here. As I said last night, I'm humbled to be here in front of you to spend time with you this weekend as we look at this topic. As I look out, there's so many of you that are friends that have traveled a great way to be here tonight, and I appreciate that more than I can tell you. Appreciate always the opportunity we have to be together. And as Josh said, as he opened, there's on a Saturday night a lot of other places you can be doing. We've got a good crowd, and the Cats are playing. Granted, they're not playing very good, but they're playing. And it's good that you're here, and that your desire tonight was to focus on these things and try to get better. Another thing I want to hit on that Josh said, and I probably should have opened with this last night, but any questions or concerns or applications or anything you have about the things that we talk about and things that we discuss as we try to put this together, if you've got questions, please, what my job here is for this weekend is to try to help you look at stewardship from a biblical perspective. And if there's anything, any questions I can answer, anything I can do to help you with that, as you're taking notes, as you're looking at things, you say, you know what, I kind of got a question about how this applies in this area, please. That's what I'm here for. The only thing I ask is that you don't throw any rotten fruit. I mean, cabbages are okay, but the tomatoes will stain. But outside of that, I'm happy to talk with you about whatever I can do to help. I was reading an article in the paper not too long ago about a fellow that was down in West Palm Beach, Florida. And a movie crew had approached him as he was standing outside in front of the house and said, "Hey, we'd like to film a scene here and we'd like to use your house for this scene." They said, you know, it's an action scene, and this house is a very nice house in a very nice neighborhood. They said, you know, it's probably going to tear up the yard, and it's going to be a mess, but listen, we're going to compensate you for that. We're going to make sure that we take care of the damages, and we'll pay you, and we'll take care of it. And so as production, the guy agrees to it, signs the contract and paperwork, and as production starts, and this carnage just starts piling up. They start wrecking cars in front, setting stuff on fire. It's wild. The neighbors have no idea what's going on. And they get really worried and really concerned. And so one of the neighbors picks up the phone and calls the owner, who's a friend, and calls the owner, and the owner picks up the phone and says, "What are you doing at the house?" He says, "What do you mean?" The owner's in New York City where he lives. He's got the house rented out. He says, "Why are there cars wrecked in front of my house?" They said, "That's what we're asking you." The owner says, "Hold on, I'll get to the bottom of this." He calls his tenant that's living in the house and says, "What are you doing?" And the tenant says, "Well, they're going to pay for the damages and I'm going to make a little money, and I figured as long as you didn't know, everything would be all right." You see, that's part of our problem here with stewardship, isn't it? When we're entrusted with these things of God, as we started talking about last night, we assume that we can use and misuse what God has entrusted us with. And as long as God doesn't know about it, or maybe we can kind of try and keep it from Him, that we can do whatever we want to do in the darkness or in the shadows, or if we're not called on it immediately. See, this idea of stewardship, of what we're entrusted with, And granted, it's a loose analogy there because that guy's paying rent and God's just placed things in our hands. But I think the principle is still the same. That the labor and work that God has entrusted us with, the resources that He's placed in our hands to do this great work, we've got to be very careful about how we're going to use what's been entrusted to us. And as we started last night, if you weren't here last night, just by way of quick summary, when we talk about stewardship, this is a word that over time, words that are used in especially the King James or the New King James Version of the Bible, they're words that we just don't use anymore. They fall out of favor. And we replace them with other words. And the word that and principle that we're looking at, here this week is that of a fiduciary. Now what do I mean by fiduciary? By fiduciary, I mean a person to whom property or power is entrusted for the benefit of another. Another word we use is trustee. Another word we use is power of attorney. So the concept here is that stewardship, let's take that word that we don't use out, and I'm God's fiduciary. I'm God's power of attorney. I'm God's trustee. And God's possessions, God's resources, He's given to me and has given me a task and said, you know, Mike, I've given you a soul, I've given you a body, I've given you goods, I've given you talents, and here's the work of the kingdom. He said, I've entrusted you with all of these resources to be able to accomplish this great task. And you're accomplishing it on my behalf using my resources. And as we began last night, the areas of stewardship that we're talking about, and this is, please understand, this is not an exhaustive list. We're talking about four main areas. And those areas are souls, our bodies, our goods, and our talents. And as we set forth five stewardship principles last night, and again, if you weren't here last night, Josh has posted on the website. We shared it out there on Facebook and linked it to the Lakeside page. Please go and listen to that. I think it's very helpful to understand that lesson in the context of everything else we're doing. But we're going to touch on each of those five stewardship principles as they apply tonight to our souls. I made a decision several years ago in preaching that as I looked at myself and started looking inward and thinking about all the sermons that I've heard over my entire life, that oftentimes what us preachers do is we get up here and we talk about things and we give you a concept, and then we never quite get around, at least I didn't, get around to telling you how to apply that concept. So a lot of times the sermon that you would hear on stewardship is the one that we gave last night. And then, good luck. Go out there and try to do it. So I decided several years ago that what I'm going to do is give you some actionable things that you can use. Let's start with a concept, and then how does this apply to our souls? How does it apply to our bodies? How does it apply to our goods? How does it apply to our talents? How do we make this stuff actually work? To be crude about it, just nuts and bolts. Well, what are we talking about doing here? And we're going to talk tonight about some actionable items around our souls. When I say we've got to be good stewards, good fiduciaries, good powers of attorney, good trustees of these souls, what are we even talking about? Our souls that we have to touch on, that we have to understand, what are we talking about here? Our souls are an immortal spirit. This is the immortal part of man that is crafted and made in God's image. This is the only part of man that lives on. This is the hard part for all of us really to get our mind wrapped around, is this soul. What part of me is eternal? This body's obviously not eternal because it's a mess. It's worse every day. The body's falling apart. And I know as I read in 1 Corinthians that in an instant, in the twinkling of an eye, we're all going to be changed. That which is corruptible is going to put on that which is incorruptible. So I know this is going away. But what lives on? What part of us did God breathe life into, and what part of that is continuing on? What part of me is going to be in heaven? Or what part of me is going to be in hell? What are we talking about as this eternal, this immortal peace? I'm convinced that this part of us that's crafted in the image of God is our understanding, our mind, our ability to reason, to think. I'm convinced this is our imagination. This is our will. And this is the fullness of the broad range of emotions that we have. That this is the immortal part of me that lives on. What we refer to it, and Paul, as he talks about, that we'll have peace in mind in God. That mind, that is our thoughts. That is what is love and hatred, joy and sorrow. Representing those things that are closely dependent on it, like good and evil, desire and aversion, hope and fear. With respect to things present and things to come. The glimpses that we get into eternity, that's one of the difficult things when we read the scriptures, right? We read the Bible and we look, and we're not given the full picture of eternity, are we? We get a peek, right? Every once in a while, they pull back the curtains and you can see just a little bit. Now, whether we're talking about, and in Luke chapter 15 with the rich man and Lazarus and that great gulf and divide that's fixed between Hades and paradise, that which is in Abraham's bosom and that which is in torment. Whether we're talking about there and what's left, or whether we're talking about John's picture into heaven as he's called up into the third heavens, if it were, in the book of Revelation. The picture we get there of that which is either gathered around the throne of God singing praises without end, safely in Abraham's bosom, or that is tormented, isn't what's physical, is it? The rich man, when he begs, what does he say? He knows, I've got brothers. I've got those left behind. Let me go back and tell them, if I can't have relief, if you can't even dip your pinky in the water and put it on me to cool me off, if I can't have relief, at least let me go and tell my brothers before it's too late for them. What's the statement there? They don't believe the law and the prophets, and neither will they believe one, even though he raised from the dead. Right? What is there to raise back from the dead but the mind, the thought, the emotion, the essence of who we are? And when we get down to who we are, who we really and truly are, isn't that what we're talking about? Our personalities, the characteristics, your thought, your mind? If you didn't see me physically and you just heard me and we talked on the phone, what is it that you know it's me? Maybe the sound of my voice? But isn't it that reasoning, that back and forth, that conversation that connects us, the broad range of emotions, if it were, the memories that we call on, our will, our train of affections, the thing that is, those things that are important to us and define who we are as far as our character, as far as our being. When you say you know somebody, what do you know? You know who they are, right? Maybe not necessarily just what they look like, but I know him. There are people that I don't know, but I've seen their face before. I could pick them out of a crowd. Yeah, they've been to Danville or they've been to Lakeside, but I don't know them. What do we mean when I say I know that person? We know this about them, right? We know their personality. We know their imagination. We know their will. We know their range of emotions. We know how they act or react in certain situations. We know about them. With this broad range of emotions that we have, with this will, with this imagination, with this understanding, with our thoughts, we are to be stewards over. We are to be fiduciaries over. We are to be powers of attorney. We are to be trustees over even our own thoughts. I want to let that sink in for just a minute. Because how deep and how personal are our thoughts? How many of us have thought things and didn't say them because we knew better? Right? That happens to me, I'd like to say daily, but hourly, minutely, there's all kinds of things that I know better than to say, but they're thoughts. And our thoughts, as we craft them, as we're putting our mind around them, as we're trying to figure it out, and some of us have a better filter than others about what goes in the head that comes out of the mouth. But aren't those mine? Aren't those mine? Don't I have some type of ownership over even the things that I think or my emotions? Can't I just feel how I feel? No. No, I argue from scriptures that even our thoughts, our desires, our emotions, all of that, God gave us for a purpose. And you see, when we lure ourselves into the false sense of confidence that this or any part of this is mine, that ownership, remember we talked about a lot of that last night? The difference between when somebody else owns something and when I own it, we treat it differently, we act differently, we react differently. But these are God's thoughts. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 10 that every careless word that a man utters, he'll be judged by. Why? Because they're not His words. God's words. They're God's thoughts. They're God's actions and reactions and emotions. And when we allow ourselves to be ruled by these emotions to drive us to the desires and to not what they were intended for, Isn't that where we get in trouble, folks? The idea of lust or sexual desire isn't bad. It's not. Beautiful and wonderful and God-given, right? But what's the context of that? It's for a spouse. A man may desire his wife. A wife may desire her husband. Hebrews chapter 13, the marriage bed is undefiled and the fullness of it. All of those things have a context. But what if that desire isn't God's and wasn't placed in me by God for a certain and specific use to my spouse, but I say that desire is mine and I'm going to be ruled by it? You know what that's called? Fornication. Improper sexual action. But Mike, I just have a burning desire to do this, and I'm going to do whatever I want to do because it's my desire, it's my emotion, it's my feeling. But it's not. God placed that into us, that full range of emotion, that we're made and crafted in His image, and He said, this is for this. Not for anything else. It's for this purpose. And when we take and we misuse desires, when we misuse emotions, when we misuse the thought process and our imaginations for things that are unholy or unrighteous or contrary to God, what difference does it make between that and if I use my body immorally or if I use the goods or the talents? It's easier for us, I think, in most cases to say, all right, God's blessed me with some money, what stewardship normally is preached on and about, that I've got this money, and it would be wrong for me to take this money that God's given me and gamble or spend it on prostitutes or steal or all these immoral things. Yeah, Mike, I get that. But my thoughts and my emotions are off limits. I'm not giving those under control or under yield to anybody. Isn't that the agenda of those that push homosexuality? You have a right to feel and love whoever you want to love. And the pushback you get when you push that thought to its natural conclusion, which is if it's okay to love and feel and desire for anything that you want, what's the end? What's the end? A man can marry a man? Can a man marry a child? Can a man marry a beast? Can a man marry a toaster? I mean, what's the end? If the definition is a committed, loving relationship, I can make that anything. Right? It's not just the act. It's the thought, the desire, what's behind the act. Even our love that God has entrusted us with, that God has taught us so much about, is controlled. God says, that's mine. And let's think about this. How does God say to love, and how do we love? Because it's different. What does God say about love? We can go to 1 Corinthians and read about what love's supposed to be. What deep, meaningful love is supposed to be. Bears all things, hopes all things, believes all things, trusts all things. That's what love is. We don't love like that, do we? We love based on reciprocity. I love you as long as you do something for me, right? We fall out of love when I don't get something back. Isn't that how it works? If I love you because you do some stuff for me, you stop doing that stuff for me, all of a sudden I'm out of love. Isn't that why the divorce rate in this country is over 50%? I just don't love him anymore. I woke up today and I just don't love anymore. Well, God says that love is a learned exercise, and it's self-sacrificial. It's not a fleeting emotion. And God says that we should love Him not for what He gives us, but for who He is. There's a difference there. It's not reciprocity. Think about every relationship you have that's failed. Just for a moment. Every relationship you had that's failed, what happened? There was a breakdown somewhere where you didn't get what you needed, right? That's what happened. I'll pick on Michael Ray because he's a good friend of mine. And I love Michael, and a lot of our relationship is built on kind of some wit and intellect. We go back and forth on a lot of things in a very dry, and for most people in the room wouldn't understand the terrible level of humor that we're at. But that's our relationship, right? And I love him and his family, and we've been friends for a lot of years. But in most relationships, that would end if he runs out of jokes. Michael wakes up one day, goes blank, no jokes, we can't be friends anymore. Right? That's how our relationships end, don't they? I stopped getting what we needed. And what do we say? You changed. We grew apart. I stopped getting what I needed. So therefore, I don't love you anymore. We can't be friends anymore. We got to move on. I got to go find somebody else that'll get me what I want. But that's not how God defines love, is it? Not how God defines love. God says love is different. That love is deeper. That the love that He requires us to have for Him and then for each other is not in any way, shape, or form based on reciprocity. It's based on the love that God has for us. And how does God love us? What in the world did we ever do or provide to God that we deserve His love for us? Does anybody have an answer for that? Because I don't. Scriptures don't. God loved us when we were enemies, right? When we hated Him. I mean, if we're very, very honest with ourselves about New Testament times and when Jesus came back, the Jews that existed weren't really Jews. Were they? Somebody show me in Leviticus anything that they were doing. The high priest wasn't after the order of Aaron. They weren't worshiping in a temple. And what in the world's a synagogue, and where did it come from? What's a Pharisee? What's a Sadducee? And find me them in Leviticus or Deuteronomy. Find any of that stuff. It was a manufactured religion. It had gotten so watered down and so far away from God. Listen to the prophet Malachi. In Malachi chapter 1, what does Malachi say? Oh, that somebody would bar the doors of the temple. It's so bad that I wish you would just lock the place up because I don't want it anymore. That's how bad it had gotten. That God said, please, somebody lock it up. And may it never be that He'd say that for what we're doing here at Lakeside. Can you imagine if Josh got a letter from God that said, Josh, I wish you all would just bulldoze the building. Because what you're doing there has nothing to do with me. This stuff that you call worship, it's not about me. Just bulldoze it. I'd rather you not do it at all than what you do. But what's the world say about love and about respect? We love God so much that we'll do whatever we want and call it God's. As if that ever worked. Well, I love God, so I'm going to, you know, dance for God, or I'm going to box for God. I mean, whatever. I mean, fill in the blanks. There's all kinds of things out there that the world has decided I'm going to do for God because supposedly I love God and God loves this. When God said, if you don't do it my way, Malachi, I wish somebody just locked this place up. God says even our desires, even our base emotions, desires, and thoughts we're entrusted with. We don't own them. So what does that mean when we go back to our stewardship principles? What does that mean? How do we now we kind of understand what our souls are, right? How do we plug this in? Stewardship principle number one. God is the grantor and owner of all things. Remember our three parties of the trust agreement? There's the grantor, the one that accumulated all the possessions, and He's the one that gives. Then there is the trustee, the one that manages. And then our third party is the beneficiary, the one that receives benefit of all of these goods and resources. Okay? If God grants us emotion, intellect, thought, if He grants us both anger and fear, desire and shun, love and hate, if our thoughts are not our own, but yet they belong to God, how do we use them? Turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. I just love me some Solomon. I love Solomon for a lot of reasons, because the main thing I love about Solomon is the perfect test case for us, right? Because whatever you think you can do to make you happy, Solomon already did it, and he did it better than you can. You think chasing after women's going to make you happy? He had 900 wives and concubines. You think money? He had more money than anybody would ever have and ever accumulate on the face of the earth. You think it's power? Look at the borders of the kingdom. He controlled much of the known world at that time. What do you think is going to make you happy? Solomon had it better. What did he say? I love this. Whatever my eye desired, I did not withhold it from myself. Whatever I wanted, I got. Okay? Solomon did all that. And listen to what Solomon says. In Ecclesiastes, this is the end of Solomon's life. After he tried all that stuff, after none of it worked, and Solomon's sitting down and he's writing, and he's like, I've got to get this out. And people, Solomon, again, I believe, fully inspired by the Holy Spirit, is trying to press these principles upon us to say, just think about this. And he says, for everything there's a season, a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather all the stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, to keep and to cast away, to tear and to sow, to keep silence and to speak, to love and to hate, for war and for peace. You know what Solomon's saying there very, very eloquently? Every range of desire and emotion that God has entrusted us with has a place. Has a place. I want you to think about that. The Creator of the heavens and the earth gave us, remember when we talked about all of God's possessions and how He grants them to us last night? He gives them to us according to measure, ability, and capability, right? So you know some people in your life that are deep feelers, that are emotional, that just feel greater than you do. I'm not that guy. God made me all with the other side of the brain. I'm math. 1 + 1 = 2. I don't care that you don't like 2 or that 2 is the wrong color. 1 + 1 = 2. There are other people that say 1 + 1 feels like 2.5. And that's how they make decisions. It's not right or wrong. But that part of emotion, that person, is not less valuable than I am. We need them in the body. Because here's my problem with being mathematical, with everything having to, I get out my calculator and do it. I struggle with compassion because I don't feel it. I feel return. And if we invest in you, then what's that expected return going to be? That's how Mike thinks about stuff. And I've worked all of my life and have struggled and try to be more compassionate. But people that feel deeper, they're more willing to extend compassion, to extend grace, to extend forgiveness than somebody that doesn't. We need them. We balance. Remember when Paul writes to the church at Corinth and they're having all the problems and they're fighting back and forth and they can't get on the same page? What does he say? Every part of the body is crucial. We need it. The mouth can't say to the feet, I don't need you, because you need the feet to go get the food to put in the mouth, right? We need every piece of this body. And there's a time and a place for every single emotion, thought, desire, feeling that we have. Here's the hard one, folks. There's a time that we should hate some stuff. Oh, no, absolutely not. This is, God is love. And then, wait a minute. You know, preacher, don't get up here and tell us that there's a time to hate. There's a time to hate. Time to hate some stuff that are an abomination to God. There's a time to be jealous. Oh, that's an ugly word. We teach our kids never to be jealous. There's some things we should be jealous of. God said that I am a jealous God when you go and spend time with idols. Isn't that what God said? Wait a minute. If jealousy is always wrong and always bad, then we've got to say God sinned, right? No, Mike, I'm not saying that. I would never say that God sinned. Right. Then jealousy has a time and a place. There's a time for war. There's a time to argue and there's a time to disagree. There's a time when all of us have to take a stand. And there's a time that all of us should fall back. There are various movements, even within the brotherhood of conservative Christians, of members of churches of Christ, of members of the Lord's body. And a growing pendulum goes back and forth. There are some brethren that always want to fight. And they'll fight you about everything. Color of the carpet to the order of services. Can't believe you liberal people sing two songs before the prayer. There are some people that wouldn't fight you for anything. You could wheel a piano and a jazz band up here on stage and be like, well, let's try it. There's a time to fight. There's a time to discuss. There's a time that we fall back. There's some things that we shouldn't fight about. That's what Romans 14 is about. There are some brethren that put everything in Romans 14, and there are some brethren that put nothing in Romans 14. There's balance, friends. God gave us these emotions, these desires, these thoughts, these feelings for a reason and a purpose, and that's what Solomon says. Solomon says you get unbalanced when you take away one side of the equation. Again, I know some of you hate me and want to throw fruit right now because I keep using math terms, but I'm sorry. But how does an equation get out of balance? How does a balance beam get out of balance? You got too much stuff on one side or the other, right? That's how it gets out of balance. Solomon says there's a time for all of this. The feelings that you have that you were naturally given, empowered with, blessed with, all have a proper place. And where is that place? In the kingdom. See, here's what we do with this stuff. There are people that will fight in the world, in their job, for things that are important to them, whether it be financial, monetary, power, career, whatever that is. They'll fight tooth and nail for that. But you get them in a Bible discussion and they're passive as anything. Why is that? Well, God gave me this fire, but I can't use that fire in the kingdom. What? That doesn't even make sense. We take God's blessings, what God has empowered us with, what God has given to make us great, to make us wonderful, to make us who we ought to be. And friends, we just don't use all the tools in the toolbox. And we wonder why our lives are out of balance. We wonder why our churches are out of balance. We wonder why our marriages are out of balance. Because all these tools that God has given us, we didn't figure out how the tools worked. We didn't figure out which ones we should use for which time and which project. We just said, hey, I don't need that. Now, let's think about this. I'm going to get away from math because I keep getting bad stares. But all of us, in some way, shape, or form or another, have worked with tools, right? We know what tools are. What if you decided that you just didn't need a hammer anymore? You know what? I hate that hammer. I'm throwing it away. But every time you needed to use a hammer, you had to try to use a wrench. Now, I know some of you have been on a job site and didn't have a hammer and have tried to use a wrench to bang in a nail. And how'd that turn out? Terribly, right? But we try to make something fit in a place that it wasn't designed for, right? And we struggle and we're frustrated and we wonder why the project didn't turn out the way it should have. We didn't use the right tool, did we? Anybody ever have not the right tools they need for a job and that project turned out exactly the way it was supposed to? No. We may have got there with some duct tape, but it's not the way it should have been. God grants us all of these things for a specific reason and a specific purpose. Secondly, we are trustees, fiduciary stewards of God's possessions. So I'm going to try to say this real clean and clear. Our thoughts, our emotions, our desires are not our own. You know what that means? That means when I delude myself into a false sense of confidence to say I can hide from God because I can hide from my brethren, if you spend your time and hours at night in the deep hole of internet pornography and say, I'm not hurting anybody because nobody knows, you're lying to yourself. You've deluded yourself. When you say, hey, I can be in business and in practice, and what I do, I can lie and cheat and rob people to increase my revenue and beat them out of it, and it doesn't hurt anybody because I'm following proper business practices. No, no. That belongs to God. Those desires, those thoughts, those feelings all belong to God. And just as in our analogy when we started, the tenant didn't have the right to give away ownership of the property to the production company, you do not have the right to give away ownership of your thoughts, of your emotions, of your feelings, of your will to anybody else. Because you don't own it. I don't own it. I can't say this is just okay. I can black this out. I don't have to be compassionate. I don't have to be loving. I can be cold. There's a brother that he's come quite a long way now, but the congregation I was worshiping with for a long time, this brother would show up before services and sit outside in the parking lot in his car until services started. He made sure he was the last one in. Before the closing prayer was over, he was the first one back out the door. He sat the entire time in services with his arms crossed and a scowl on his face. And when I talked to him about his attitude, about, you know, help me understand where you are, he would say, brother, if you read Revelation, there were some in congregations that were still robed in white. But he thought, I know God says I need to be friendly and be a part of the body, but I'm out on that. I don't have those emotions. He does, because he has a family and he's got to be friendly at least somewhat to have a family, right? But we can't turn stuff off and say, I'm just out on that. I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to turn off these feelings. I'm going to turn off these emotions. I'm going to turn off these desires. And I'm not going to use them in their proper context. I'm just going to give them away. We're powers of attorney. Every last possession that God places into our hands, we have to use. And we have to use it to God's glory. There are some that have been blessed with a great desire for leadership and ability. There are some that you know in your life that you come in contact that were natural born leaders. That from the time they were in elementary school, people gravitated to them and wanted to follow them and wanted to do stuff. They just had a pull, a magnetism. And some of those people have gone on to start great companies and run organizations and lead people and use that thought, that will, that imagination, that process to build great empires. But what's the proper place for that? Was it wrong for them to build empires? Nope. What was wrong is they didn't build the Lord's church. Because see, all of those tools that God gave them was to build the Lord's church. I mentioned last night about great leaders of industry, the Jack Welchers of the world, the Bill Gates of the world, the Steve Jobs of the world, and the things that they did. Imagine that will, that thought, that drive, that intellect, that imagination, if it would have been used in the Lord's church. What would those churches look like? What would those bodies look like if you had those men as elders? One of the great travesties within any congregation is when there are huge generation gaps and there are no elders, no leaders. And sometimes it happens just by circumstance. Sometimes it's been that way for 60 or 70 years. The biggest failure of leadership is to not train the next generation of leaders. Think about it. This is a good study for you, and we don't have time to go through it here tonight, but I just want to put this in your mind. when Moses is leading the people out of Egypt, I want you to carefully read the text when Moses is in front of God, when Moses is getting direction and he's going back out to the people. Read the list of people that's there next to him. You know a name that you're going to keep showing up? Joshua. Joshua's right there at Moses' hip. As a young man, as a child. Had to be because years after Moses died, he's leading the people through the promised land and taking that promised land. But notice, when you go back and read those passages, this is one of my terrible faults. I skim read. I don't read every single word for every single detail. And a lot of times, in my own Bible study, I miss stuff. And sometimes when I go back and I read it and I'm studying for something else, all of a sudden this stuff just jumps out at me and smacks me in the face. And this happened to me a few years ago when I was preparing to teach an adult class about Joshua and his leadership style as he took the promised land and led those people that just spent 40 years walking in circles. And when I went back and I read the prep work before Joshua, I found him always at the hip of Moses, always learning. And then when Joshua is taking over the promised land and Joshua is interacting with God, guess how many people are in that list? And Joshua went before God. And Joshua was there and entreated God for the people. It wasn't Joshua and Caleb or Joshua and somebody else. And so what happened after Joshua died? There was no leadership and we've got the judges cycle, right? And as that judges cycle keeps going around, what happens? It gets worse every time. It's worse every time until finally you get judges like Samson. If we're not stewards, trustees, fiduciaries, powers of attorney of our thought, of our process, of our imagination, of our will, of our wit, of our drive, of our desire, and we don't use it in its proper place, there will arise a generation that knows not God. There will arise a generation that there is no elders. There will arise a generation that sadly today I'm seeing where there's very few young gospel preachers. Look at the median age of gospel preachers. Just think about it the next time you have a bunch of... Look back the last 10, 15 years of meetings that's happened here at Lakeside. How many of those people were under 35? How many were north of 50? How many preachers are out there that you can name off the top of your head that are younger than 35? How many can you name that are pushing that are 50 plus? Failure to be a good steward of these things causes imbalance. And there arise generations that can't fill the roles that they were supposed to. Third, God will supply to the needs of the trustee, of the power of attorney, of the fiduciary. Now, when this comes to our own wit, our own intellect, our own thought, our own desires, if we properly use all of these things, that's where joy lies. That's where, and I want to draw a strong distinction between joy and happiness, because those things are very, very different. God does not want you to be happy. God doesn't get up every day and say, hey, how can I make Mike happy today? Let's see what I can do. Not how God works. But God says if you use your emotion, your thought, your intellect, your desires, if you use all of those in their proper context, the byproduct of that is long-lasting joy. Happiness is fleeting. I can be happy one minute and crying the next. Right? It can happen. Happiness is fleeting. Joy is long-lasting. If we do things God's way, the way God desired for us to do, we will have long-lasting joy. Joy regardless of our circumstances. You want to talk about joy regardless of circumstances? One of the most terribly misused scriptures that I'm convinced in all of the Bible is Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13. What's Philippians 4 and verse 13? Most of us can quote this. I can do all things through God who strengthens me. And how often do you hear that in terms of an athlete that's won an award? Or somebody that presses on. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And I'm going to hit this 50-foot three-pointer to win the game. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. But folks, let's get something real clear. I'm never dunking a basketball. I'm not going to the NBA. I don't care how much strength God gives me, I don't have the tools. You know what the context for that is? Go back and start in verse 10. Paul says, I can do without. I can live with no assets, with no resources, with no home, with no earthly possessions, and I'm still in joy, filled with joy. So I want you to think about this. Paul said he could be homeless and still have a long-lasting joy. How many of us could honestly say if you lost everything tomorrow, the government came, bulldozed your house, pulled you out, threw you under a bridge somewhere in a cardboard box that you could say, you know what, I'm doing good today. Paul said, I can. And I did it. Because he understood that the joy came based on his relationship with God and not based on his relationship with the things that God gave him. Remember that thorn in the flesh? How many of us get aggravated with ailments? By all accounts, Paul was losing his eyesight. How difficult is that to somebody that writes letters to lose your eyesight? That's in prison, that's communicating with churches that he helped establish, with people that he loved, if you can't see. Paul prayed to God several times and said, take this away. God said, my grace is sufficient. And Paul said, it was. God's teaching me to depend on him and not to depend on my eyesight. Not to depend on my flaws. God's going to take care of us. And the way in which He takes care of us is when we use things in their proper place, in their proper way. Then we will find joy. Here's what we do wrong though, right? I've got this desire, this lust that's in me. And instead of, it's better to marry than to burn, I don't want to burn, but I don't want to marry, so I'm just going to go be sexually immoral with anybody I can get my hands on. And therefore, I'm going to be happy. But what happens with that? You're happy for a moment. You're happy maybe in the midst of it. But every one of those relationships fails. You end up miserable. You don't have the long-lasting joy that comes with a deep, committed marriage built on God's marriage principles. And you wonder why it doesn't work. You wonder why you're always unhappy. We should expect to be unhappy, to be miserable, to be in sorrow when we use God's desires, emotions, thoughts in improper ways. We should expect that. God says if you do it my way, you're going to find what you're looking for. In Malachi chapter 3, God, through the prophet Malachi, is talking about tithing, about giving. And I think the principle, even though we're not talking about monetary things tonight, but we're talking about giving our thoughts, our desires, our will, our emotions, our full range of faculties to God. He says, put me to the test. If you give it to me, see that I will not open the stores of heaven and rain down blessings upon you. My challenge to you tonight in these things that typically are off limits to God, because they're mine, I challenge you to put God to the test and see that He won't supply to your needs far more abundantly than you can ask or think. God's way is the right way. But we've got to trust Him. That again, back to what we talked about last night, it's a faith issue. Point four, our stewardship is a direct reflection of the faith and trust we have in God. When we start taking things off the table to God, when we start saying certain things are off limits, we're saying, God, I don't trust you. God, I know you say that the best way for me to use my desire, my passion, is within the marriage relationship. But boy, it's a whole lot better if I have 7 or 8 or 10 or 15 partners. I don't trust that the marriage relationship is everything that you say it is. I don't trust the institution of marriage. And if I don't trust the institution of marriage, what don't I really trust? The guy that came up with it, which was God. When we don't let our thoughts, our will, all of our desires be God's desires, when we start partitioning that part of our life off, what we're saying is, God, I know you said it this way. But I know I should, but I don't trust you. I don't love you enough to commit to you and say, I'm going to put you to the test. I'm going to try it your way and see if it's not better than anything I could ever dream about. 5. As with all fiduciaries, there will be a final accounting. I mentioned this a little while ago, but Jesus says, every careless word a man utters, those are what he'll be judged by. That may be, for somebody that talks a bunch, the scariest verse in all of Scripture. Because there's a lot of careless stuff that I end up saying. But there's going to be an accounting, and God's going to tell us. He's going to say, Mike, I blessed you with this much wit, with this much intellect, with this much ability. Remember we talked about those benchmarks? Mike, on your benchmark, if you would have used all that in the kingdom, here's where you ought to be. But Mike, you're way back here. And yeah, he did all this other good stuff with it, but that's not what's important to me. That was important to you. Not important to me. Here's where you ought to be. In that final accounting, God's going to have a record of every ounce of blessing that he's placed in our lives. And that terrifies me. Because most of us don't believe in ourselves as much as God believes in us. I've met and worked with teachers that have earned awards for being prominent teachers within their school district, within their county, within their state, that have never taught a Bible class. Well, Mike, I just don't think I could teach a Bible class. You were the educator of the year. How could you not teach a Bible class? But I can't get it right. And God blessed you with the skills, the talents, the ability, the wit, the intellect, the emotion to be a powerful teacher. And you used that. And you were great in the county school system. But what if you were in a Bible class? What if the young people that grew up in that congregation had you as a Bible teacher? Maybe they wouldn't have been lost. Because you reached at-risk kids in the school system. But you didn't reach my at-risk kids in the church. That could be used for Bible class teachers, deacons, elders. Here's the thing I want you to consider is, as you look at that, that first qualification when we talk about elders is that desire. You have to be a desire to be an elder. I want to encourage you, if you're qualified to be an elder, if you're thinking about being an elder, and you've ducked that first one and said, you know, I just don't have the desire. If you've been a great leader in other aspects of your life, great leader at work, team leader, manager, and you say, I don't desire to lead God's people, I think you're going to have a hard time answering that question on Judgment Day. I think you're going to have a really, really hard time when God says, this is why you were successful. Mike, this is why you were good at your job. Because I needed you to be good at my job. I needed you to be good in my kingdom. And you took what I entrusted you with and you used it somewhere else. Now again, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Back up a couple of points. God will provide to the needs of the trustee. God says you can use that in the corporate world. We're not saying you can't use the blessings in the corporate world to make a living for your family. But not to the detriment of your responsibilities in the kingdom. Why did he place these things in our hands? That's our number one question. God, why'd you give me this? The answer to that is very, very simple. For use in the kingdom. Secondly, to use to support your family. First of primary is for use in the kingdom. Wrap this up. First, these souls are a precious and a wonderful gift from God. I mean, we don't have time, and we just scratch the surface, and I've been talking way too long already tonight about how wonderful and powerful the mind and the heart is. I mean, if we started drilling down on each and every one of the emotions we have, on wit, on intellect, on recall, on memory, on passion, on all, we could spend years drilling very down to specific details on these. We are amazing creations. And many of us, if we're very honest with ourselves, we're blessed way, way beyond what any of us deserve. Second, in the full range of our lives, when God requires his soul back, what do we do with it? What'd you do with it? What'd I do with it? When you look back on the achievements and accomplishments of your life, and I encourage you tonight, go home and sit down with a pen and paper and write down your accomplishments, your achievements in life, professionally, socially, what you've done. And think about what base skill set you were blessed with that allowed you to accomplish that. And then start writing down what your successes were in the kingdom. And what maybe they could have been, or should have been, or would have been, or can be, if we started applying those same things. If you're a great salesperson, and you've made a killing selling products, services to people, but you've never talked to somebody about the gospel, I'm going to ask you why you're good at sales. God's going to say, Mike, you're a great salesperson. I put all the skills and abilities in you to sell like fire, but you should have been selling the gospel. You should have worked that in somewhere. What do we do with it? Did we squander it away? Was it frivolous? Did we hold it for ourselves? Did we just turn it off and mark it out? Because that final accounting is going to come. Tonight, the first step in this is what all of us have been blessed with, is life and time. And tonight you're here. And you're here and you've got an opportunity to make a decision, to use that intellect God has given you, to use that will, that drive, that determination that God has given you, to use all of that to make a decision about the Christ. To read, to comprehend, and to say, based on from Genesis to Revelation, everybody that's ever trusted in God, it's worked out for good. Should I go ahead and take that step and trust in God and think it's going to be good for me too? To let go of the other things that we think that are important? To let go of the cares and the concerns and all the other ways that we tried it? And to start trusting God. Confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Use that desire, that burn within us that calls out for God that we've filled with everything else. And say that's because of the Son of God. Be buried with Him in baptism. Have all those sins washed away tonight. Rise out of those waters to newness of life. Being a good power of attorney. Fiduciary. Trustee of everything that's in that God has put in your hands and your life. And do it to the fullness of your ability. Knowing that God is the giver of every good and perfect thing. And that God has trust and confidence in you, otherwise He'd have never given it to you in the first place. So as much as we sometimes don't trust ourselves, I want to tell you tonight, God trusts you. And God has put all of His faith, His effort, and His energy into you. Well, what are you going to do about it? If you're not a child of God, the answer is you haven't done anything about it. You're just robbing. Fix that tonight. All things are ready. If you are a child of God, but you've gotten lost in this, you've been hoarding blessings, you've been hoarding this, and you need to make some changes. You need to talk about that. You need to make public confession for public sins. Or wherever you, whatever you need. Don't squander this opportunity. Don't squander that decision-making ability and that voice in the back of your head that says, I got to fix this. Let us help you. Let us do whatever we can right now as we stand and as we sing.